Most things still remain to be done. A glorious future. Ingvar Kamprad, IKEA founder. IKEA, as of 2024, does $50 billion in revenue, has 216,000 employees, and reaches a billion people on their websites every year, and another billion visit their hundreds of physical stores worldwide. In Bertel Torkel's, the author of the IKEA story, words, "The story of IKEA can be summarized as an 100-year true story of one of the miracles of the Swedish welfare state. Starting on March 30th, 1926, the day Ingvar Kamprad was born, it is a story of a farm boy who grew up in the 1930s, an era of unemployment and uncertain future dreams, and who, age 17, started up his mail-order company in the country in the middle of the ongoing war. Snuff under his lip, a traditional southern Swedish purse in his pocket, a glimmer in his eye, the slightly unpolished language, the persistent myth of being a miser, fundamentally also a well-considered leadership principle, and his second-hand Volvo, together with the brilliance of the concept combined, this is enough for people to take both the man and the company to their hearts, even at times when he comes under fire for the political mistakes of his youth. What does IKEA do that no one else does? One answer relates to the founder's determination to keep IKEA a private company. While the stock market prioritizes share value gain, a group owned by a foundation and controlled by family can choose a long-term approach, sustainable development. It stays true to its motto, create a better everyday life for the many people. I'm actually reminded of Richard Branson's definition of what a business is. Branson says, a business is a group of people coming together to improve people's lives. It's as simple as that. Low prices, quality, and design for the general public has confirmed its inherent limitless possibilities. The more global IKEA becomes, the more it seems to cherish its Swedish heritage, which is another unique factor for its success. What built IKEA up are the virtues: diligence, energy, thrift, inventiveness, humility. Ingvar Kamprad doesn't want to be remembered as just a good businessman, but as a man who wanted to build a better world, innovator, and adventurer in a single person. Unique distribution strategy. IKEA store as a center surrounded by a shopping mall with 250 stores in Moscow attracts 60 million visitors every year. And even if 10% of them visit the IKEA store is exposed to 6 million wallets and accompanying dreams. IKEA was built up from scratch by a farm boy, starting with nothing but love, encouragement, innate energy, desire for revenge, imagination, and curiosity. He was a man with hands full of resolute dreams, a heart tormented by inadequacy and self-pity, and a stubborn and inquisitive enterprise, a strange mixture of social, animal, and an eccentric. As Steve Jobs would say, the rebels, the misfits, the square pegs in a round hole. It appears to me that losing his mother, 53 years of age, when he was 30 years old, made a big impact on him. As a young kid, Ingvar was doing business deals like buying matchboxes in bulk and selling them for small profit, selling Christmas cards and wall hangings, selling fish he had caught himself by cycling around the town. When he was 11, he sold garden seeds from J.P. Person Company. He made his first profits from. Selling became an obsession. It is fascinating to see, actually, how early struggles and challenges in life inform, influence, and impress a person's mind. These are some of my thoughts on this section of the book that I'm using as a reference. They also, how they transfer those experiences of their childhood into building products that become insanely great. It was no different in Ingvar's case. And we see this even with Steve Jobs and a few others. When he was 10, Ingvar, walking in the wild with his father, Fyodor, they came to a place at which his father said, "I'd like to make a forest track here, but it would cost too much." Then they were soon somewhere else, and again it was money that was lacking to carry out father's many plans. "I remember thinking," Ingvar says, "if only I could help father. Suppose I got some money, what if?" An interesting story when Ingvar was a kid. He was chased by his father for wrangling the neck of a chicken. His grandmother was protective of him. She grabbed him and shook her fist at his father. "Don't you dare touch my little boy." Not only she protected him from the outside world, but encouraged his entrepreneurial ventures by being a faithful customer. That gave him confidence to go out and sell to neighbors. We all need these small first wins. I recall for me that turning point in my own life actually was being super competitive when it came to art competitions. Winning small competitions built that confidence in me to go after big ones. Going back to Ingvar's story, the revenge, "Young man, you will never become a businessman. If I decided in my own mind to do something, then I would do it." So this was something that one of the store owners in his town, he used to buy stuff from and then resell those products like pencils and things like that. And that person, I think at one point, says to him, "Young man, you will never become a businessman." And that, I think, was another interesting turning point for Ingvar. Very salient features of founders who went on to build insanely great products. Many great products started out as childish business ideas. IKEA, which stands for Ingvar Kamprad Elmtrud Agner, started as one such, and so have Snap, Instagram, Facebook, and many others started that way too. Ingvar realized very early on, key to product success is distribution. Another key lesson we take away is his observation, identifying problems in the current setup. For example, he goes to a shoe shop which had white shoe boxes stacked all the way to the ceiling and then had a ladder to go down, up and down to fetch the boxes from the top of the stack. What a waste of time and money, he thought. In 1948, he advertised furniture for the first time, calling it test furniture, and sold a lot of it. Up until then, he was selling small wares like Christmas cards, seeds, fountain pens, etc. He also started a newsletter called IKEA News, began to publish and send to customers, adding product details to the newsletter, which helped him move all the furniture. Distribution. Giving names to furniture became a thing because he had a hard time remembering order numbers. He observed that his fiercest competitor was selling furniture, and so he started doing the same. There were a number of small furniture makers in Lake Moquin, where he lived, which made it a natural fit. This sort of similarities I see, some of them, again, my notes here on the side, similarities with Phil Knight's story of selling Onitsuka Tiger shoes from Japan for over a decade before starting Nike. The lesson for me is to start selling, start understanding the intricacies of the ecosystem, the customers, the supply chain, etc. And don't try to do it all yourself. At first, you can resell or do whatever it takes to understand the users, the supply chain, supply and demand. It truly helps to establish product requirements, filling in gaps where others are failing, etc. I think these are all some important points I made note of. To get started quickly and try to sell something to somebody and then understand what sells, what doesn't sell, what some customer pain points are, and then building on top of it. Very interesting way to start a company that happens to be a $50 billion company now after several decades. From early on, going back to the book, Ingvar was focused on learning how to get distribution for his products. He learned from Ivar Sundbom, one of his teachers and professor of economics. The question he wanted to answer was, how do I get the product from factory to the customer in the simplest and cheapest way? You know, he was, I guess, thinking dropshipping in 1940s. Ingvar didn't set out to sell furniture or become the gold standard in built to assemble flat pack furniture. It was by chance, merely trying to imitate competition. Wow, this is again my notes, like, a $49 billion mega corp started out this way, we should feel comfortable starting small, making something people want, and bumping into ideas purely based on customer needs and wants rather than making shit up inside the building. What a beautiful lesson, right? Like, Ingvar just didn't set out to sell furniture and become this gold standard in building flat pack furniture. It just happened to be a problem that they had to solve, and they solved it. Going back to Ingvar's words here, my interest initially was purely commercial, selling as much decent furniture as I could as cheaply as possible. Not until the first complaints started coming in did I realize that it was quality that was lacking. One day, that would force me to draw certain conclusions and choose another way. Ingvar continued to do business selling pens and ballpoints. He also sold watches to various watchmakers in Stockholm. One of the lessons he learned early on was negotiating on price with his sellers. Gunnar's in Alvesta. Ingvar went down to Gunnar's at Alvesta to purchase watches. Gunnar Jansson offered him a score of watches for 55 kronors, roughly $7. And Ingvar tried to appease to him with his young and aspiring businessman who wanted to be like Gunnar. He said that he can only pay 50 kronor. Gunnar budged a bit and says, okay boy, I'll give them to you for 52 kronor. Ingvar, knowing very well that it won't leave much profit, accepts the deal. Gunnar gives Ingvar a lesson for his life. Boy, if you offer to pay 50 kronor and I said I will accept 52 kronor, you should have negotiated 52 kronor and 50 or, instead of accepting the offer straight away, because in our business, 10 or can make all the difference in the world. That's a life lesson for Ingvar as a kid. Starting in 1949, Ingvar started sending out a supplement to the Farmers' National Weekly Paper. In it, he wrote, to the people of the countryside, you must have noticed that it is not easy to make ends meet. Why is this? You yourself produce goods of various kinds, like milk, grain, potatoes, etc. And I suppose you do not receive too much payment for them, and yet everything is fantastically expensive. To a great extent, this is due to the middlemen. Compare what you receive for a kilo of pork with what shops ask for it. In several areas, it is unfortunately true that goods that may cost, say, 1 krona to manufacture cost 5-6 krona to buy. In this price list, we have taken a step in the right direction by offering you goods at the same price your dealer buys for, in some cases even lower. He started the case for a direct purchase with no middlemen, and the brochure showed, among many other items, a little furniture, a chest of drawers and elm veneer, a pedestal table that could be raised and lowered, a combined chair, ladder and some old bookcases. This is super impressive. Again, my notes here on the side. Ingvar was a scrappy and ingenious founder. He has not created products of his own at this time. Similar to Phil Knight of Nike, we discussed in the last episode, Ingvar was essentially doing some kind of retail arbitrage, buying pens and other items at lower price and selling them for a small profit. The thing that impresses me is his distribution idea to reach mass market. Number one, he joined forces with National Farmers Weekly Paper. And number two, he also had his own newsletter called IKEA News. It mainly offered fountain pen called Admiral Osmia. The retail price was 28 kronor. Wholesale price was 11.2 kronor for at least 10 pence. And Then he was also a marketing genius. At the top of his IKEA newspaper, he wrote, "Doctors, scientists, armed service farmers, foresters, seamen, school children, everyone needs the pen sensation of 1948. Back to the book. Ingvar was interesting in serving the general public. In this case, people living in the country. IKEA catalog was born in 1951. The catalog that today, half century later, is distributed all over the world and printed more than 200 million copies. In the spring of 1951, Ingvar made what he considers the most important IKEA ever made. Most important appointment IKEA ever made. Interview with Sven Goldie Hansen, who became an office clerk and 2 years later became the head of the newly opened furniture exhibition in Almhult. And during the pioneer days, a member of the small management team that decided everything. In Ingvar's words about Sven, he was a great expert on pricing strategies. Sven Goldie came to IKEA at a time competition in mail order business was heating up. For example, the Melby ironing board was sold by us one season for 23 kroner. Then Gunners lowered the price to 22.50. We followed with 22 kroner and the spiral continued. Step by step, the price war affected the quality of the ironing board. It became simpler and simpler, but also worse and worse. Complaints started mounting, and I could see how things are going. The mail order business was risking an increasingly bad reputation. In the long run, IKEA could not survive this. They needed a way to re-establish the trust with customer. Many lessons here, actually, on my notes on the sidebar. Here, including paying less attention to competition and more to customer, not getting into the price wars, but innovate on behalf of customers, and not sacrifice quality of the product to keep customer trust. One of the ideas, going back to the story, one of the ideas to re-establish trust was to offer mail order customers a way to touch and feel the products and compare the quality of various options before purchasing, which led to a permanent exhibition display of the furniture. For these physical display exhibition, Ingvar buys a building that hosted a business that was closing for 13,000 kroners, which in today's price would be 2 billion plus kroners. Similar to Sam Walton, actually, and his long-term leasing and buying real estate away from the city lines worked out very well for IKEA. Their customer acquisition strategy was to send out print catalogs, tempt people to come to the exhibition, have a spacious exhibition building in which customers would walk around and see simple interiors for themselves, touch the furniture they wanted to buy, and then write out a check for mail order. More similarities with Walmart and Sam Walton. For the first exhibit, they invited people to come and see and promised free coffee and buns. 1,000 people showed up, waiting long queue. Ingvar and team were scared if there would be enough buns or if the floor would hold so many people. This reminds me of the Walmart story, one of the episodes I had done in the past. You can check that out. More recently, the initial new iPhone launches where hundreds of people would wait in long queues outside the Apple store. Similar to that, here we see Ingvar's initial store exhibition for IKEA in the 1950s. Long queues of people waiting to, you know, see the exhibition. But the floor held and the buns were swiftly baked. Over those first few years, tens of thousands of people from all over Sweden would go on a pilgrimage to remote Almhult. No business is done on an empty stomach, Ingvar would say. Today, restaurants business brings in 10 billion plus kronors to IKEA. Their free catalog, the infamous IKEA catalog with photographs of furniture in a real life setting. It was way back in the 1990s. I saw one of these catalogs actually, and I didn't want to throw it in trash like every other mail catalog. I actually wanted to keep this on my coffee table. It was beautifully designed, right? And This is again my notes. Wonderful photography, clean lines, typography anyone would envy, and every page was exquisite. It was a show off to keep the catalog on the coffee table as a signal to the to my guests coming to our home that we understand and appreciate great art and design. Going back to Ingvar's story, small experiments before major launches is a good way to go about building products. Like, this is something I heard from one of the clips about Tom Cruise talking about this, how you run small experiments. Tom Cruise likes to say, like, crawl before you walk, walk before you jog, jog before you run, run before you sprint, and sprint out of the airplane, sprint before you sprint out of an airplane. This is exactly how he does some of his stunts in his movies. This is an excellent analogy that we can adapt in building insanely great products as well. Going back to the story here, life in country was coming to an end. IKEA was taking shape as a real firm. It could be said that we simply transferred the family spirit from Elmtured. Helpfulness, thrift, and a strong sense of responsibility. I remember one small episode. One morning, I found that our cashier had forgotten about a roll of postage stamps on the table. I was extremely annoyed. I calculated how much the stamps were worth and put the corresponding sum of money, perhaps 15 kroner, on the table. Then, in red in face, she came and told me someone had put some money on the table for stamps she had forgotten to lock up. She has never forgotten that. It was a lesson in what things are worth. To this day, at IKEA, we try to translate everything into a clear price and state it. Clear and simple pricing strategy, again, this is my notes, is a superpower actually for an insanely great product. I think a lot of startups and founders and companies, even small to mid-sized companies, struggle with complex pricing strategies and waste cycles, millions of minutes of meetings trying to come up with these pricing strategies. Just keep the price as simple as possible. If it is complex for you, it's super complex for the customers. For example, like price of an Apple iPhone, Apple MacBook, etc., fixed and universal, at least it used to be a superpower of Apple. Like, you didn't need to find a deal or get frustrated searching for a deal online, right? Like, you can feel safe buying it anywhere because you know and you're very confident about the price, right? You're not missing out on some crazy deal somewhere. Going back to the story, in Almhult, the question of food became acute for special reasons. People were coming from all over the country. IKEA had become Almhult's tourist attraction, even a tiny bit more popular than the famous Linnaeus birthplace. Traveling was expensive. We arranged a discount with Swedish Railways. And those who furnished their home with us for a while were offered dinner at the new hotel at Almhult. I think this is crazy. I mean, I'm just thinking aloud here, like, you know, how much you care for the customer, I think shows in some of these things that you do. Serving buns and coffee, giving them dinner, giving them a free hotel. I mean, these are all giving them a discount on the Swedish Railways. I think it shows how deeply you empathize and care for the customer and how much love you pour into what you build. And that's, again, some parts of, that's not all of it, but essential parts of making an insanely great product. Sometimes some fairly simple observations and some modest improvements led to major decisions. Step by step, we were building our future philosophy. Well, IKEA is today Sweden's biggest food exporter. In 2010 and 11, when this book was updated, the sales at IKEA's restaurants and exit shops, which sells Swedish foods, exceeded 10 billion kroner, or about 1.1 billion euros. It is interesting to note the backdrop of how IKEA came about and possible tailwinds that helped it into a national, international conglomerate. Second World War ended and people were starting to build homes, move into new apartments, and one of the first things people needed as they moved into a home was furniture. Americanization was on the rise. Sweden was first among the European nations to become influenced heavily by American movies, culture. 50,000 farms closed in 1950s alone. By 1980s, 75% of the agricultural jobs were gone, and the suburbs grew as if sprouting out of the ground outside the cities. This eerily sort of is relevant even today, like in the 80s, as the agriculture, 75% of the agricultural jobs sort of vanished. I can see a similar trend happening now with AI, and over the next decade or so, we'll see a lot of, like 75% of the so-called tech jobs and others will go away, and new types of jobs will emerge. Very interesting side note. Again, going back to the story here, a housing authority was formed, which even had a publication called Good Housing, which set the regulations for minimum living space and thoroughly outlined the requirements for every room and every part of a dwelling, utility room, kitchen, hall, and so on. A rich flora blossomed in Sweden post-Second World War. A multitude of dynamic family-owned companies such as Tetra Pak and Hennes and Mortis, many of them grew strong in their local environment, where they became the monopoly before expanding to the wider world beyond Almhult. All of them had a story to tell about how they were small and poverty-stricken to sophisticated business success, honor and wealth. That was what it was like when IKEA was born. Again, my sidebar note, this reminds me of Peter Thiel's lecture on 0 to 1 and how competition is for losers. Like, building a monopoly business is the way to go, and to do that, you don't start with a big market. You start small in an obscure segment. Example, Amazon and books, Facebook and Harvard, eBay and pest dispensers, PayPal and eBay power sellers, 20,000 of them, that's all. And then have a plan to expand to take over the world, but those who started with taking over the world, like many energy companies did in the 2010s, folded. Why? Why does this work so well, like starting small and expanding? What are some patterns here to follow other than start with a small market? I think something to think about, I think because this is a seed of an idea that sort of seems to have helped a lot of insanely great product companies. Going back to Ingvar's story here on IKEA and the products they've created, even IKEA started out as a small mail-order catalog furniture dealer to taking over an entire furniture trade. Dream home for a dream price. That was the tagline. It was on the front of the still simple catalog in 1955. Dream home for a dream price. Pretty simple. And aspirational and inspiring. Ingvar was a cockroach, a fighter, and a founder with those qualities it's potent. There is no stopping them. In a letter from the National Association of Furniture Dealers, IKEA was likened to a monster with 7 heads. If you cut off one, another soon grows. All of these boycotts and furor was because of IKEA's low prices. I have personally suppressed most of the difficulties of boycott days. I drew one conclusion, that it never pays to work negatively. This is Ingvar speaking. That was what was wrong with my colleagues. They acted negatively, trying to put a brake on things and banning instead of competing positively and meeting us with their own constructive ideas. Who knows if we would have been successful if they gave an honest fight. The boycott, however, reinforced our unity and forced us to find new solutions. Regard every problem as a possibility. IKEA's business philosophy and golden rule. For example, when we were not allowed to buy the same furniture that others were, we were forced to design our own. And that came to provide us with a style of our own, a design of our own. Gillis Lundgren was furniture designer and the 4th employee of IKEA. He was their original photographer for the catalog. I'm so impressed by his artwork, the sunlit rooms and shades. The IKEA photos are simply marvelous, in my opinion. On one occasion, they photographed a table and were packing it up when Gillis muttered something like, "God, what a lot of space these legs take up. Let's take the legs off and put them under the tabletop." And that's it. That was the origins of a whole new design and industry of flat-packed furniture. It was not only a space saver, but also helped reduce broken furniture in transport and lowered their freight costs. Gillis was an artist. Oh, I love artists who know what they're doing and can make an art into meaningful and useful design. I'm sure I'm butchering the name Gillis, but I'll go with Gillis. I hope it's not Gillis, but Gillis traveled with Ingvar to furniture manufacturers and saw their products and how they were made. He would make lightning sketches and wondered if they could be made differently. Thus, self-assembled bookcases, chairs, beds, and other pieces successively appeared. In my appeal to the people of the countryside, remember the supplement he was putting in the Farm Weekly newsletter in 1949, I had written about eliminating costly middlemen and urged people to buy direct from the factory through us. But not until the mid-1950s, when IKEA opened their first real store, they were ready to combine design, function, and price. Early on, we traveled around the country unannounced, checked the quality at the factories, always looking for small savings that made a great difference to the ultimate price. I had an awakening, a kind of awakening on the idea level when I went to Milan Fair and visited a large carpet supplier. Thanks to him, I was able to see ordinary Italian households, the homes of simple clerks and workers. What I saw surprised me. Heavy dark furniture, a single light bulb above heavy dining room table, a chasm between all the elegance at their fair and what could be seen in the homes of ordinary people. Milan gave me a shove in the direction of what my marketing manager, Leonard Ekmark, calls democratic design. A design that was not just good, but also from the start adapted machine production and thus cheap to produce. With such design and innovative self-assembly, we could save a great deal of money in the factories and transport and pass on the savings to customers. Ingvar Fyodor and Ragnar Sturti visit Poznan in Poland and are disappointed by the quality of the products. Although Russians were buying up these products in loads, it was a necessity to make a profit for the post-war manufacturers, but slowly and steadily, IKEA worked with manufacturers in Poland to build up the furniture industry. Also, just going back to my previous point, note from in terms of the Italian households and clerks, how the fair was versus how their home setup was. I can see how Ingvar was able to fill the gap by using beautiful photography in real home settings and created this beautiful catalog with some really amazing photography that sort of shows people, hey, what is the possible, out of the possible here? And, with low-cost furniture at a very high quality also, they were able to now, I guess, see the homes in that light. I think that's very beautiful and very powerful. So going to the story where Russians were buying up these low-quality products from, Poland, but IKEA goes in and sort of builds this furniture industry. How are some of IKEA's favorites like Ogla, Billy, Tor, were created right here in Poland? Patience and empathy for the local people and context helped a lot. Ogla chair became a symbol of IKEA quality at a low price. It was as good as the chair many people paid a lot of money for on the quote-unquote posh street. When Berlin Wall fell, people went to work for German manufacturers and Swedes were forced to pay higher prices. IKEA's orders from Poland dropped from 100 million to 50 million, and IKEA found other Eastern European regions to fill that gap. IKEA had their share of problems. Their reputation was at stake many times. For example, when there was an uproar due to a news article published that stated IKEA's bookcases were using formaldehyde, which emits poisonous fumes inside the house. IKEA used facts and honesty to address the issue. They quickly replaced affected products for free and regained customer trust. When there was a question of quality versus price, IKEA did everything to ensure form, function, and price are sharp, but never at the cost of quality. They had a third-party test their furniture and compare it with five times more expensive furniture. For example, the Ogla chair, which costs just 33 kronors, was put to test against a high-priced chair, where the chairs were put in a spinning machine that spun the chairs around dozens of times, and Ogla won the quality test. It came out unscathed, while the competing chair was damaged. Later, IKEA hired Bo Wadling to improve the company's test laboratory in Almholt. He earned a place in IKEA's history for installing testing machines at store entrances, where customers can see for themselves chairs being tortured right before their eyes. Anyone who could prove that they're on the side of the customer will win sales. I think this is an extraordinary line from the book. Anyone who could prove that they're on the side of the customer will win sales. A lot of the times we see companies getting into this mode of, we need to increase sales, we need to sell more of the platform, we need to increase usage, we need to have bigger average customer order sizes, this, that, bundling, all kinds of crappy strategies, while forgetting the very basic fundamental thing, which is anyone who could prove that they're on the side of the customer will win sales. It's as simple as that. And product builders who want to build insanely great products, we must not lose sight of this customer obsession, as Jeff Bezos would call it. What was simple was beautiful. Again, this is a line, quoting Ingvar. Simple designs and products is one of the most underrated superpower. Again, this is my notes on that line of insanely great products. Simplicity, simple designs and products. Hey, where is the manual for iPhone, for example? Well, I don't know. I've never looked at one in my 15 years of using and owning an iPhone. Why? It's because it's simple. The product is designed very simply. No complex menus, buttons, whatever. And then you come to work for an enterprise SaaS company and you're wondering what is going on with the product there, right? Self-service was another innovation that has helped IKEA reduce the highest costs of the furniture buying process, that is delivery and unpacking of the furniture. Very smart move, right? Self-service, resulting in lower prices for the consumers. All the products were given names. This is another unique thing about IKEA. All the products, if you go to IKEA store, you'll see, or their website and look at the catalog, you'll see names, like Ogla and Tori and so on. All the products were given names. We talked about briefly earlier, partly because Ingvar actually found it very difficult with the numbers and he loved naming things, so he insisted that everything be named in sort of like Swedish English. So for example, suites, sofas, chairs were always given a city name, and bookcases were given boy's name, and curtains were given girl's names. Duvets were given bridge names, the Washington Bridge and so on. of the Golden Gate Bridge. I don't know if they actually use those names in the product, but I'm just saying. And for example, an armchair was called Stable. S-T-A-B-I-L. That is again Swedish pronunciation or spelling for stable. The English word stable, because it was definitely stable, the chair. Ingvar decided to name everything because he had difficulty with the numbers. These names are spelled like they are in Swedish and are the same across the world. Ingvar developed a culture at IKEA that seems to resemble more a family than a sports team that Reed Hastings of Netflix has built. Again, this is my note here. Ingvar's, IKEA's culture is more closer to a family than a sports team. And both of them were interesting and very successful, right? I mean, we know
Netflix is another $40 billion company today, has built amazing culture around the sports team analogy. I think both are quite successful in their own ways. And just have to pick what suits you, I guess, and the type of culture you want to build as a founder. When Ingvar was asked by a business student, "What is fundamental to leadership?" That was a question someone asked him. And Ingvar's response was, it's one word, love. Talking about culture at IKEA, employees say things like, "I was in harmony with myself working at IKEA," or "We joined IKEA because it suited our way of life to avoid thinking status, smart clothes, and so on." None of the older employees believed they joined IKEA for the money. This reminds me of another wonderful episode that I did, I plan to do on Patagonia, and I am reminded of Patagonia founder's words again here in terms of building a company that suits your lifestyle, not just yours as a founder, but also the employees who join you are also like that. Like, for example, Patagonia founder. So he takes off 6 months in every year and goes off and does what he loves to do, like fishing and rock climbing and so on. I think that's the way he wants to lead a life. And that's the reason why he kept the company private, Patagonia. Patagonia is still a private company, mostly owned by him and his wife. And it does $1 billion in revenue. They could grow and become a $10 billion company? Yeah, probably. But again, is that the kind of way of life that you want? Is something you have to decide. And those are the cultural values that you build, which influence, obviously, the products you build. Ingvar did not want to expand quickly. Again, similar to Patagonia founders. Ingvar did not want to expand quickly by taking on funding from outside. There were questions that often came up, like why IKEA has not entered this market, that market, for example, like Brazil, which was very similar to Sweden. In Ingvar's eyes, companies were not just capital. This one line, we'll end this episode with this one line, and it's beautifully said and it's very powerful. In Ingvar's eyes, companies were not just capital. They were also people, ideas, culture, and history. Stop and think, Ingvar says. You don't just plant the culture, the soul, and the family spirit in any old potato patch. And that's the way to build companies and the company culture with strong people, strong ideas, strong culture, and trying to create history. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe to Products Podcast, and I will see you in the next episode.